My name is Clancy Immerslund, and I'm an alcoholic. Some kind of freaks. I'm very glad to be here this evening. Glad to be safe and sane and sober, as I like to say. Glad to be back to the Pockets of Enthusiasm Conference, which I've always enjoyed attending. I didn't know I was speaking till I got here tonight. Didn't know I was speaking at 8:30 tonight. And I was just kind of lolling around but sitting on the ramp in Washington, watching it rain. And I didn't think there's any hurry at all, but I got here and they quick told me I had to talk, and I had no chance to prepare a memorized talk, so I'll have to just ad lib it now. But I'm glad to talk on the subject of sponsorship, because I believe strongly in sponsorship. That's the most important thing I know in AA as a human element. And I know nothing more vital in my life than sponsorship. Now, there are those around AA who smirk and say, the book doesn't mention sponsors. And it doesn't. It doesn't mention meetings. It doesn't mention GSO. It doesn't mention anything. Just except how to stay sober. But all these things, on the other hand, I went to a convention in 1960, the International Convention, and I heard Bill Wilson get up and say, I'd like to introduce my sponsor, Ebbie Thatcher, who got up and talked. And that was good enough for Bill Wilson, it's good enough for me. That's the funny thing about Ebbie, you know, it's a touching thing that he should introduce him as a sponsor. Remember, Ebbie made a call on him and got him interested, then he talked to him in the hospital. And Ebbie was Bill's sponsor. But after a while, it wasn't very long, a year or two, Ebbie got drunk. Then he got sober again. Then he got drunk again. Got sober again, got drunk, off and on, from then on. Finally, in the early 1950s, Ebbie was, he was really in bad shape. So there was an old guy down in Dallas named Searcy, who was an active in sponsorship. So Bill Wilson sent Ebbie down to Searcy, and he sent him out to Midland, Texas, and they really worked on him with action and involvement, and he stayed sober. That was in 1953. By 1960, he was sober 7 years, the longest he'd ever been sober. And Bill was pleased to invite him to come to speak at the International Convention in Long Beach. I remember I didn't have a long talk, but I met him and heard him talk. And here's the irony. He went back to Texas really upset, because Bill had gotten all that attention. And he said, I'm his sponsor. I didn't get as much attention as he had. It never struck him that he never stayed sober. I was his sponsor. He didn't it didn't give me very good treatment. So he got drunk again. And then so by this time he was getting incompetent. So Bill took him up to New York State and put him in a rest home, and he stayed there till he died. But you can't really count on your sponsor to do that very often. You got to really do what he says. I had a very difficult time in Alcoholics Anonymous, in and out, in and out, in and out, because Alcoholics Anonymous did not really seem to apply to the problems that bothered me. In the first place, I could not believe I was really an alcoholic. I hear these old fools talk about being an alcoholic. Now, they were alcoholics. You know. I stayed drunk around the clock for 25 years. And one day I walked through that door, and they told me to put the plug in the jug, and I did. And I've just never been so goddamn happy. Adios, muchacho. And if you're new, some new people here, I'm sure, and it doesn't take long to discover what this is about. An alcoholic is a person whose problem is alcohol. When it gets bad enough, he comes to Alcoholics Anonymous and admits the fact that he's an alcoholic. And then he returns to God, and then he helps others, and they live happily ever after, apparently. And I went to AA off and on for a long time. And I could not accept that phenomenon for a very simple reason. My problem really wasn't alcohol. It was. Is our starting time inconvenient? Any of you feel free to get up and move about. I'll nail you. That's all right. I'll tell you something sad. Last Wednesday, 9 days ago, was my birthday, my A birthday. And I thought, on this birthday, I'm going to mellow out and become gentle and good. Well, next year. And I'm really looking forward to it because I'm tired of being this way. But my problem is not alcohol. My problem, I have a lot of problems, a lot of emotions. When I was a boy, I remember thinking there's something wrong with me or something missing in me. Because, I don't know, it just seemed like there's something missing. I didn't know what it was, but people seemed to recognize it. They always liked me at a distance, but up close they didn't really like me so well, it didn't seem. And I didn't really know what to say to people. I didn't feel good. And I had a little difficulty. When I was a kid, I could read fast. And I was pretty smart. So they shoved me ahead in school a grade and a half, which added to the, because I was with older kids. And I had to start being a smart aleck in order to be noticed. And I'd start getting in trouble. But I always felt there's, in fact, what is it? I thought when I grew up, it's going to be all right. And I grew up and it wasn't all right. It's almost as though, I look back at my life, it's almost as though, if you're supposed to feel like this most of the time, I felt like this a lot of the time. Didn't know why. And I went to a psychiatrist, and I was somewhat successful as a writer. And I spent thousands of dollars trying to discover why I had these emotions of feeling different and less than sometimes and not fitting in and kind of unclean somehow. And I found out some very good reasons why I was that way. I found out that I had been badly scarred by the Depression. I didn't even know there'd been a Depression. But once he explained it, I could really see it. I was badly hurt by running away from home at 15 and running off to sea in the Second World War, and where nobody knew where I was except my commanders. And I always thought that was one of the exciting time of my life. But after the psychiatrist explained it to me, I could realize what a scar it had left. My parents divorced. I suppose there's probably some truth to that. Because I was raised in a very strict Norwegian Lutheran home with a lot of structure. And in the Norwegian Lutheran Church, very strict church. Most of you have never seen any examples of it. One of the reasons why, I think, 2 or 3 years ago I was talking in Oslo, and after the convention they took me up to where my grandparents had come from. They all had left there in the 1880s. They told me about in the 1880s a whole wave of Norwegians had gone to America to get out of that damn climate. And they all settled in Montana and North Dakota and Wisconsin. Spent the rest of their life saying, Jesus is cold here too. That's the kind of head I face every morning when I get up. But you wouldn't see anybody here. It's too warm here. But I was raised in this church, and I could sing little songs in Norwegian. I was catechized and confirmed. And I was getting straight A's in school, and I didn't know that I was strict. Everybody else doing the same thing. So how do you know? You never know. We were poor and strict. I didn't know we were poor. I didn't know we were strict. When I was about 11 years old, my parents got a divorce. Now, that doesn't sound like much. People get divorced all the time. But can you imagine this? I had never heard of a divorce when my parents got divorced. Nobody in our church ever got divorced. Nobody in our family ever got divorced. And it really left me, what the hell? Someone explained to me at length. I could understand it. But I really could not understand it emotionally. And in a way, it really did change my life with regard that I seem to have a flair for doing wrong things. I've been trained to do right things, but I can't do them. I have no experience in doing wrong things, but I do them just like that. And what I did then was, without being aware of it, I did the worst thing I could have done. I began playing my mother against my father to avoid structure. And my mother would get on my case, I'd run to my dad and tell him stories about her. If he'd go on my case, I'd run to my mother and tell her stories about him. If both of them got me, I went to my grandma. And little by little, I fooled him. And I fooled him and fooled him. And I just outsmarted him everywhere. By the time I was 15, I totally outsmarted everybody. I was flunking out of high school. I had no friends left. I'd become a smart aleck, just a smart mouth, cynical little snot. And I don't know what would have become of me. If the war hadn't started, I think I'd have been in the penitentiary. But the war started, that caught my attention, and through a series of events, I ran away from home and got to the Pacific Ocean, where I had my first drink, incidentally. But he pointed out how this divorce had scarred me. And I could see that. A lot of things over the years that he pointed out to me, and I could really see how these things would happen. I'd stop afterwards and have a drink or two and think, God, no wonder I feel bad. It's just, it took me almost a year and a lot of money to realize I now knew what made me feel this way, but I still felt that way. So what good is that? The only possible use of that information might be late at night in a bar somewhere, some big moose like Larry coming over and says, "What the hell is wrong with you?" And you can tell him. I was scarred by the depression. I read books. I did a lot of things. But getting a drink, and when I drank in the, getting close to Pearl Harbor, the first part of the war, that was the first time I didn't know what it did, but that makes the scale go away. I suppose another way I could put it down, I look back, that is the first time I ever felt the way men looked. God, what a good feeling that is. And the last drink I took many years later, standing on a street corner with my teeth kicked out and everything gone, if somebody had said to me, "Why do you drink?" I could have given a lot of good reasons, psychological reasons, intellectual reasons, a lot of reasons. But I suppose that probably I would have known the right answer, but the right answer would include because it makes me feel the way men look. But I stayed standing on a street corner in Los Angeles, and standing on the street corner, if someone had come up to me that morning, I stood in the rain. But let me set up a little bit. The night before, it was cold, Halloween. I didn't know it was Halloween. I'd gone to a costume ball and won a prize. Because they'd say, "Oh, that's really realistic blood on the front of your shirt." "Yeah, I was thinking." And I just had my front teeth kicked out in the Phoenix drunk tank. I think that's funny. Wait till I get to the part where I get a fatal disease and die. You'll like that. Anyway, but I stood there and my life was over. I stood there in the rain. I'd just been thrown out of the night before Halloween. Some guy gave me 50 cents and I went to an all-night movies on Skid. There were three in a row then. And I hadn't been on Skid Row very long. I hadn't been in town very long, but I went to that all-night movie and came out in the morning. I don't know if any of you know about all-night movies. They don't run all night. They run until about 5 o'clock in the morning. Then they wake you up. Then you check and see if you got your shoes, because sometimes they take your shoes. But I come out sick and hungover and so sick and Jesus, and depressed and out in the cold rain. And just, God, how can this be? I said, "Let's go up to the blood bank and sell a pint of blood." Okay. So we went up 4th Street to a blood bank. We got there about maybe 5:45. And the thing opened at 6. That was called the blood bank, the dance hall, which was a sardonic way because before they opened, always the guys out in front were just... Sounds funny, but it's really so sad. And I went in and they took a drop of blood in my ear to test it. They said I didn't have enough iron in my blood, so I couldn't sell a pint of blood for $4. And the rest of them went in and I went out. And I said, gee, I'm so sick, what can I do? He said, well, down here about four blocks at the corner of Wilkes, Los Angeles Street, it's the midnight mission. Go down there, maybe give something to eat. I walked down there in the rain. I didn't know anything going on. I went there and I said, I'm really hungry, guys. Could you let me have something to eat? He said, well, you're too late. We stopped serving half an hour ago. I look, I'm not really a bum. I'm in bad shape, but I'm not a bum. I'm really hungry and I'm very, very sick. Couldn't you just let me have a little something? He said, I have to wait till noon for lunch. I said, damn it. And I grabbed him. I said, God damn it, I want some food. And he said, you shouldn't have done that. And he had two guys come over and threw me out the front door. I said, don't come back. Don't come back, son of a bitch. And I wanted to explain to him, I'm not a son of a bitch. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the Elsie Dummer ads for the Borden Company, were running out very weak in Life and Time and New Yorker serving post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times? But it's really hard to explain these things in midair. And I stood there in the cold rain. And finally, I found out where the AA club was. And if any of you plan to become long-term slippers or are, let me give you a clue. Whenever you get really down and out, there's no place you can go except an AA club. That's the only place in the world where the worse you look, the better they like it. This one's mine, Jim. And I walked a long way after that club and another club, and had a terrible time. I sat around and it was raining. I wanted to stop raining. I'd been in so many AA clubs and damn old steps and traditions and all this crap and the phony hypocrites and nonsense. And that night there was a meeting and they had cake and I ate about 4 pounds of the cake because I could chew that. I missed meeting and sat there. They talked about gratitude and I almost puked it up again. Just, oh, God. And everybody went home. It's still raining. They all jumped in their cars and went home. And there's nothing out there. And I thought, God, if I go out there in the rain, then I'll die. I'll die in that street. So I put on my newcomer look. I saved it for, that's going to the whip, you know. I said to him, I'm new, and I have no place to go. And I'm cold, and I'm sick, and I'm afraid I'll die in the rain. Could you help me? I probably didn't look that good, but I thought I would do it. I probably looked 99. And he said, you're in luck, kid. A guy named Joe Quinn left an old 49 Merc in the parking lot last summer. You can sleep in that. AA's answer in Los Angeles is to sleep in an abandoned car. Yeah, good deal, huh? Yeah, that's a good deal. I slept in that old abandoned car that night, and the next morning I got up and went in the club, and the manager said, you know, you're supposed to be a member to be in this club in the daytime. At night you can come in here for the meetings, but the daytime you have to be members only. He looked at me and he said, but you won't last out there in that rain. I know that. So you can come in here, but you can't ask anybody for money. None of your smart remarks. And you have to go to our meeting every night. Oh, Jesus. If I had a coin, I'd have flipped it. Yeah. But I lurked. And remember the first night, the next night I was sleeping out there in that car. It was cold. There'd been another meeting. I had about 4 pounds of cake. And I was laying in that bed, trying to go to sleep, and I was cold. And I remember thinking, maybe I'm dead. Maybe this is what hell is. Maybe hell is not fire and brimstone. Maybe it's just being cold and sick, and your mouth bleeds, and you feel so bad, and nobody cares if you live or die, and everywhere you go, you hear people behind you laughing at you. And it's going to be this for eternity. God, I thought, how can I get out of it? But I had no idea that would be my sobriety date. Didn't want it to be, ever. I'll tell you what is my sobriety date. Because in those meetings I went to that week in that club, I just sat and hated them and resisted them and their phoniness, and I thought they were phony. But I saw a guy in the meetings that I had seen in the movies. A movie actor. what does the movie actor tell you? A rich man. So I thought, I bet he needs a new friend. Maybe he needs a companion. I edged up to him, but he didn't. He blew me off like a hot rock. But later in the week, I was going to these meetings and eating the cake. And once in a while, these people in the club would buy me soft things and to eat. And that was just terrible. Just wait, if I could just stop raining it out of there. But later in the week, you know, they started doing me, you know, you're staying in that car all the time. You're going to die out there, kid. Well, you better get a sponsor. I didn't want to tell them. I've had 20 sponsors. They're all a piece of crap. I mean, they mean well, but they're dumb. Better get a sponsor. Well, maybe. Now. So I come up to the actor. I said, Bob, it's been called to my attention that I need a sponsor. And I really admire your program, Bob. I said, will you be my sponsor? He said, okay, but I want you to do what I tell you. Oh, sure, Bob. And he became my sponsor. Long, long list of sponsors. I'll tell you, I had a lot of sponsors. In Dallas, when I was going well, my sponsor there was a children's doctor. And I used to be my sponsor to save me some expenses. I had a lot of kids who got sick a lot. I've had the editor of the El Paso Times be my sponsor when I needed a job there. I've tried to combine sponsorship with reality whenever I had a chance. And then stay away from him if you possibly could. But he became my sponsor. And they said I found out later he wasn't a movie actor. He wasn't a star at all. He'd been in 3 movies as a character actor. I saw him in 2 of them, so I thought he must be a star. I've been in more movies in the last 10 years than he ever was. But I didn't know that then. I thought he was a rich movie star. And they said he wasn't a very good actor, but he was. Because he acted nicely at meetings. And that took a lot of acting for him, I'll tell you. Because he turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig of the worst sort. Just, do this, do that. And I thought, why am I taking this crap from this guy? One reason only. Because he is my only meal ticket out of there that I could see. And I thought, if I stop training, I get some about dough out of this idiot, I'll be out of here. I'll be gone like the wind. And it turned out later he didn't like me. Now you think, maybe your sponsor doesn't like you. Well, a lot of sponsors, I sponsor people I don't like. Some of them. No one in particular. I used to not like the taper, but the tapes always kept get screwed up. So I sure like the taper here. Yeah. But he didn't like me, and I know why he didn't like me. And I don't want to brag, but I was the worst type of newcomer there is in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it seems like I'm over-exaggerating, but I've sponsored a couple people like that over the years, and they really are. They come into the room and say, hi. And I just wish you had a rifle. Here's high. Lay there and bleed, you bastard. I'll tell you what kind of newcomer that is. That's the guy who's around AA, hangs around AA, doesn't ever do much, complains, whines, finally gets drunk, comes back, wants attention, hits on the new girls, hangs around, can't tell them anything. They all know so much. Go get drunk eventually and come back and again and again. And after a while, you can't tell them anything. They don't want to hear anything. They think they know so much. And they're just destructive forces. And that's what I was. But he was a good man, and he tried to help me. And he helped me. He saved my life, although I didn't know at the time. I'll tell you how he did it. I remember one thing I had to be careful of, because I was smarter than he was, and I had to conceal it. I mean, he was a nice man, but he wasn't really a bright bulb. He was a good man, but I was slick. And I was going to utilize this guy. I couldn't have him turn on me. So I wasn't smarter than he was. But one night, he'd say things to people. I don't know if he said it to me or somebody else. He said something one night that was just even too stupid for him. He's saying, as long as you think your problem is alcohol... You're going to die drunk. Oh, Jesus, Bob. And on the way home, I said to him, Bob, why do you say things like that? It makes me look bad. Yeah. He said, that's the truth, kid. If your problem is alcohol, you shouldn't be in AA. You're taking up space. You're wasting time. I said, come on, Bob. A little hot under the lights out there on the set today or something. I had told him the week before, I'm not an alcoholic. I do drink too much sometimes, but I'm not an alcoholic. But I do need help. And so he agreed we'll work on that basis. I said, these alcoholics, they're here because they have a drinking problem, Bob. And if you don't do something about it, you know, why tell them they don't have a drinking problem? See, I didn't say that. I said, the problem wasn't alcohol. I said, well, what is their problem, Bob? He said, their problem is something that sounds like alcohol, but it isn't. Something called alcoholism. Oh, Jesus, Bob. Don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm smarter than hell. Alcohol, alcoholism, hooray, I'm cured. Shut up, he explained. And he gave me a long harangue, most of which I was able to blot out as but some of it got through. I don't know where it got through, but it got through somewhere. And it kind of became the cornerstone of my life, in a sense, later on, and not then, because I didn't have brains. But he explained that. He said, alcohol, and if you kind of knew, you might be interested in this. An alcohol problem is you don't go to AA after all this crap. What you do, you stop drinking and clean up your act. I said, Bob, that doesn't work. I've done that 1,000 times. He said, that's right. That's because your problem isn't alcohol. Apparently you're like me. The problem is alcoholism. Well, what's the difference, Bob? He said, well, one difference is this. Here you stop drinking and clean up your act, and it has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so unpleasant you can't stand it. I said, Jesus, Bob, I've never heard that before. They all say stopping drinking is what makes it better. He said, not for people like us, it doesn't. It makes it worse. He said, it's a terrible thing. I said, well, then why do these damn alcoholics drink alcohol if they know it's a terrible thing? He said, they don't drink it because it's a terrible thing, kid. He says, and he had a glass of coffee, a cup of coffee like I did. He said, I'll tell you why they drink it. Because for the same reason I drink it. Would I have a couple drinks? Almost everything, almost instantly looks different. When I have a couple drinks, it almost instantly changes my relationship to the world around me. When I have a few drinks, almost instantly it makes me taller and more self-contained in my gut, and them smaller and less threatening to me. I said, Jesus, Bob, what's wrong with that? He said, and I'm going to quote him, I hate to say this because there are new wives here and everything, but what he said was, because it is not really happening, you asshole. I don't mind saying I was shocked. He said, it may. I said, what is that? He says, is that where you get the... He says, don't you understand it? He says, alcoholics are people who get a natural reaction to alcohol. I said, I thought that was a phenomenon of craving. He said, now, that may come, but what it is, it has to do something special for you that you need it desperately. I said, okay, I understand that. That makes sense. But now they're sober again, and now they're straightened out a little bit. Why would they drink now? They know it's going to go bad. He said, that's the other part of the problem, kid. He said, you don't seem to know much about this at all. And he had a philosophy that he told me, and I remember thinking when I was new, I didn't pay much attention, but somebody gave me a tape a few years ago when I was three or 4 years sober, and I talked about that. I never talked about it much then or then now. But I must have been 35 years without thinking about it, and I got thinking about it, and it really is accurate. His theory was when people are born and are raised, it's really tough growing up. You got to learn so much. You got to learn what to give and what to get, and that people need something from you. And you can't, people are not all interested in you. And if you have problems, you got to find a solution for them if you're going to continue. And you have to, if you have conflicts, you got to find ways to avoid the conflict or overcome it. See, if you discover that some days life is just a crap sandwich. You take a bite and swallow it. It gets better tomorrow. And on and on. He said that whole process is called maturing. And if you become a mature individual, you live rather comfortably. You can hold a job. Get along with your co-employees. Get along with your wife and children. Get along with the neighbors. You know how to act. Go on square vacations and enjoy them. So it's really great. He said, but this almost never happens to alcoholics. Why not, Bob? He said, because we've discovered along the way that we have a conflict that's especially painful or a problem. We can drink it away. Here's to you, household finance. Here's to you, bitch. I never liked you anyway. Hey, Mr. Collins, take your job and shove it up your nose. And it really works. But what I don't know, that I'm setting up a little trailer full of unsolved emotions and childish emotions. I've come to believe that what we call alcoholic emotions are childish emotions. It's nicer to say alcoholic emotions. And they've got unsolved alcoholic emotions. And the day comes for me, and I'm sure for most people, I'm going to quit. I'm going to come home after work at night, set those damn bars. I'm going to get along with the job. I'm not going to become an object of fun. I'm going to hold this next big job. It's going to really be good. I'll play with my kids. I'll mow my lawn. I'll be a citizen. And everyone knows that it's impossible to sustain that for people like me. I suppose like you. Why? Because sooner or later, someone will ignite those emotions. Someone will trigger them. Someone will hurt my feelings. Someone will say something bad about me that I hear about. Someone will, I think, is against me, trying to undermine me. And it starts the fission. And when I was a young guy, it wasn't so bad. I'd just quit the job and punch the guy in the face. But when you get older, you got kids and a family, you can't do that anymore. You've got to take it. And you've got to sometimes lie awake at night and think about those people, what they're doing to you, screwing you around. And I should have got this. They didn't give this to me. And it really mounts and mounts and mounts. Occasionally it goes down a little bit and it mounts some more. And you get to a point, it's a funny thing, some scientists say that people like us can get to a point where you literally must drink to preserve your sanity. Isn't that ironic? And so I will drink, finally. And the pilot light eventually goes on. And it's all over again. And I say, why did you screw up that job? You're doing so well. Leave me alone. That's the answer I know. And so, again and again, he says, that's what happens. Eventually, you'll always drink. People like us always drink. I said, Jesus, Bob, I never had anybody explain that to me before. We always said, if you stop drinking and clean up your act, you'll be happy. And that isn't it at all. It's all these other things. I didn't know that, Bob. That's the story of my life. I've had some big jobs. I was pretty successful. I was a sharp guy. And now here I'm standing here, a bum on the streets with no front teeth, and nobody even knows that I'm alive. It's just, that's the story of my life. He said, there's a name for people like you. I kind of hated to ask him what it was. What is it, Bob? He said, you're an alcoholic. And I said, alcoholic? My God, if that's what an alcoholic is, that's what I am. That was December of 1958, a long time ago. Last week on Halloween, it was my 49th day of birthday. Since then, since I haven't had a drink or a pill, just I'm based on that kind of information and more, of course. And I said to him, Bob, why doesn't AA explain it the way you do, instead of this cockamamie stuff about allergy of the body and obsession of the mind, all this crap? He says, they do, kid. Look over there on the wall, on this wall here. He says, look what it says on number one. It says you have to admit you're having a problem with alcohol, and you certainly admit that. Then there's a dash, which in the English language means end of thought, beginning of new thought. And you also admit you're having a problem without alcohol. I said, Because everybody knows the problem is alcohol. It's hard to understand that without it is more painful than with it. That's why we drink. And I discovered I was an alcoholic because that guy was able to explain something to me. A little later on, I was having some tough times. And one night I was feeling so bad. I said, I'd been fired again from another job. I got a bunch of little jobs and got fired. My mouth, smart aleck, and all was defensive. And I sat in the club and Bob came in. He said, "You really look terrible." I said, "I don't feel very well." "He wants you to talk to me about it." I don't talk to anybody about things like that. And I just was so filled. I'm going to tell you something. I've never told this to anybody, not to my psychiatrist, not to anybody. And if I tell you, you're going to not like me. You want to try me out. I said, "Bob, I'm a corrupt person. I'm corrupt mentally. I'm corrupt psychologically. I cheat. I lie. I use people. I just do all sorts. I was always trained to hate people like me, and I've become one in spades. And I can't blame it on my drinking. That's what I am. I'm a corrupt person." I waited for him to jump up and say, "Well, I'm moving out of here." He said, "That's all. That isn't so bad, kid. I know a lot of guys like you." And the result of that was, after that, I began to feel that maybe Bob seemed to know how I feel. That doesn't seem like much, does it, to find somebody who knows how you feel? But I'll guarantee you, I had never known anybody who I believed knew how I felt. And what's the value of having someone that you know how you feel? It's just this. Each of us in this room have had enough advice to last us 10,000 years. People like us just draw advice like a magnet from everybody in the world. Passersby, "Think you ought to go to rehab." Wait. And after a while you learn to just shine them off, you know. But if you can find someone who you believe know how you feel, that advice becomes meaningful information. I found myself, as a result of that, taking actions I don't think I'd ever take in this world. I remember standing at Brentwood meeting one night, about six blocks from where O.J. Simpson didn't kill his wife some years later. He said, "See that woman over there?" I said, "Yeah, I see her." He said, "I want you to go over and apologize to her." I said, "Why should I?" "Someone at the club told me you called her a bitch Monday night." "She is a bitch." "Why do you think she's a bitch?" "She told her new girls to stay away from me." "Well, she's right. You go apologize." I can't think of a person in the world who would have told me that I wouldn't have said, "To hell with you. Go over there and embarrass myself in front of that fat old pusbag who's been saying bad things about me everywhere I go. She's an old bag and she hates everybody. She hates me the most. I would spit on her is what I'll do." But somebody who I believe knew how I felt told me to do it. For the first time I can remember in my adult life, "I'm sorry I called you a bitch." "You bitch." "I was going to quit my little job I had one day, and my sponsor said, 'Don't quit till you get a better job.' I said, 'Jesus, Bob, it's just terrible. I'm stuffing envelopes for $1.10 an hour.' He said, 'Stay on the job.' And I stayed on the job. Didn't go to the meeting. I understand you're not going to the Friday night meeting." It's a big clique, Bob. They all suck around each other. They're all well-to-do. And they ridicule me. They laugh about me and tell stories about me. They think I'm a craphead, Bob. I said, "Maybe they know something you don't know. Go to the meeting." And on and over a period of time, little by little, my actions begin to change and my life began to change. The day kind of came, I was about a little over 6 months sober. This day I got fired as a dishwasher. Which is really, I had a little place to stay. Now I was back in the abandoned car again, which is really not much to show. People around me, unworthy pukes, are doing well. And I am a guy trying to mess him. So I decided to kill myself. Now, I might as well kill myself. I'm never going to be anything. I can't live like this. And I was going to walk. I remember A Star Is Born. Some of you aren't old enough to remember the version, but Frederick March walked into the ocean and everybody was sorry. Later on, Judy Garland and Mason, he walked in the ocean. And I liked that because it didn't seem like it hurt. So I took off for the ocean from the club. I thought to myself, probably people see me going by and think, who is that Hamlet-like figure full of tragedy? I'm sure they were saying, who's that goof, you know? But I walked and walked and walked and I couldn't find the ocean. You'd think you wouldn't lose it. And I stopped at some gas station. And I said, geez, I'm so sick. Where's the Pacific Ocean? He said, oh, you're just in Western Beverly Hills. You have to go up past the Veterans Hospital. That's about 2 more miles. Then about 5 miles after, that's the ocean. I went, well, I'm not going to walk myself to death. I was so desperate, though, I called my sponsor. I hated to tell him any bad news because he always hated it. But it only cost a nickel to call, so I called him. I said, Bob, he said, why aren't you working? I said, Bob, let me just explain something. I know you've tried to help me, and I know you've really made an effort, and I so much admire you and appreciate what you're doing, but I just can't make it, Bob. AA is not enough for you, nothing. And I need something beyond anything there is around here. I don't know what to do about it. He said, why don't you write your inventory the way I told you? And I just told him 2 weeks before that. I said, I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist. Why do I want to take it with an out-of-work actor? What are you going to do? Say, cut. Yeah. But I didn't want to say that again because it made him so upset the first time. I said, Bob, in my judgment, that's the last thing in the world I need. That's the last thing in the world. To go over that stuff, I'm so remorseful. And I have so many opportunities, and I've lost them all. And I'll never see my children again, and my parents think I'm dead. And I just, writing that down, I just don't know what I'd do. In my judgment, that's the worst thing in the world I could do. He said, in your judgment, who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. If I wanted your judgment, I'd come down and put my head in the back window and ask you for it. That made me upset. I came out of that phone booth. If I'd have turned right, I'd have been in that ocean in 5 minutes. But I went back to the A Club. Sullivan, give me some paper. I'm going to write my inventory. And I wrote and wrote and put down dirty, rotten nest and never tell anybody. Ew. Never tell my psychiatrist. Somebody said, why don't you tell your psychiatrist these things? Because when you're paying that kind of money, you can't risk rejection. That's why you don't tell your psychiatrist. You did what? Get out of my office, will you please? Wash off that chair, too. I got it all done. I had a good feeling. I had proved that writing an inventory didn't work. And that cheered me up a little bit. And I shoved in the back seat. A couple days later, he came by in his car and said, okay, get your inventory. I said, Bob, I don't think I'm quite ready for a fifth step yet. Let me just get settled down here. Now, shut up and get in the car. So I got my paper. And he drove from Los Angeles to Malibu, or to Oxnard, 40 miles away. Gave me a flashlight. Said, read it. I read it and got it read even worse than I remembered. Oh, God. We got to up near Oxnard, and I thought, he's going to make me get out of his car, and I'm going to have to walk 40 miles back. I said, Bob, well, that's the end of it, Bob. He said, are you done now? I said, yeah, I sure am, Bob. He reached over and said, it's the best thing you've done since you got sober, kid. And I said, thought it was. I've taken that same trip over 200 times since then, on the driver's side, some other puke over there. Well, let me explain this part before I read it. That's the amazing thing we discovered in Alcoholics Anonymous. All good inventories are the same. They all have different specifics, but down deep they're all the same. Guilt and shame and resentment and inadequacy. And fear and envy, just nasty, rotten things. That's why when you get out of there, you realize what what we have in common all over the world. That's what people like us have in common, emotions that make us have to drink to stand it. And I look back at those years, and the next best thing he did for me, I mean, he did a lot of things over the years. He's a good guy. But when I was able to hold a job about 5 months when I was a year and a half sober. Then after my second birthday, I got a job as a beginning writer in a medical corporation. And some guys got me some clothes at a thrift store. That looked pretty good. I went to work and I said, here's my chance to break through. I'm going to break through. I'm going to make this move. My life, I've got a new chance. And I went to work there, and I still had no front teeth, but I learned to carry my lips like this. They just thought I'd been burned in a fire. And I knocked them dead for a few days. They said, you're a great writer. And about 4 days in, somebody hurt my feelings. Heard a guy say, that guy doesn't even have any front teeth. And I got thinking about that. Oh, why would you screw me around? I didn't say anything to him. Why would he screw me around like that? Why did he try to put me down? Now people will ridicule me. God, I'm trying so hard. I just wanted a chance. I'm just going to smash his face in for him and quit this damn job. But I'd promised Bob I'd call him before I quit. So I said, Bob, for Christ's sake, kid, don't cry. You're a man now. He said, here's what you do. He told me some smarmy thing to do. Yeah. That won't work with this guy, Bob. This guy's bad news. He said, do it anyway. So I tried because I believed what he said. And I talked to the guy. I said, why did you say that? He said, no. I was telling someone, what a remarkable thing. You must have had a tough little goal somewhere in your life, and you're making a new start. And I'm very, God, we're just all proud of you. We're very pleased with what you're trying to do. And you just wonder. And he became a good friend of mine. Probably the next year or two, I must call Bob 25 times when my emotions are out of control. And he taught me new ways to act. And the time I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that big medical corporation. Had front teeth, smiled a lot. If any of you are new and have lost teeth, let me tell you something. Once you become spiritually pure, they grow back. gives them something to shoot for. And Bob, over a period of time, saved my life by telling me what to do, which is one form of sponsorship. And he is a dictator-type sponsor. And I think about that sometimes because, as unfair as it seems, in my home community, I've often been called a dictator-type sponsor because I tell people what to do. I'd want to preside over their disintegration. I tell them what to do, and people say, well, I've had dictator. I'll tell you something funny about that. People never seem to realize. In order to be a dictator-type sponsor, it requires the 100% approval of the dictatee. All he has to say is, screw you, and the dictatorship is over. You can't impose your will on anybody. That's one of the things I think when they wrote the traditions, and when they were explaining the traditions at the International Convention in Cleveland, they said, we don't have any police force to enforce these things. These are voluntary. And some of us old-timers think that may have been wrong. Sometimes it would be nice to have people come to somebody's home in the night and say, did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us to the camp for a few weeks. But for me, I know of no other thing that would have saved my life except a sponsor, and eventually a sponsor that I came to believe in. I hope to God, if you're new, that you can find someone that you believe knows how you feel. Now, oddly enough, my sponsor died. He had been my higher power. I also accepted him as my higher power because I could not get to God for a very unusual. You hear people sometimes come to me and say, I can't believe in God. My problem was just the opposite. I believed in God all my life. And I know that when I got to the point where I'd broken all 10 commandments, there was no hope for me. And I was going to go to hell. I didn't want to think about it. I don't like to hear people talk about God. That's crap. And I could not return to God. And my sponsor pointed out to me. I said, Bob, I can't return to God. He says, not that A. He says, you got to return to God. Oh, okay. To a power greater than myself, Bob. Does that fool the other boys and girls? Doesn't fool me. I know what I'm talking about. Doesn't say that either, kid. Why don't you read the damn thing? See, I should have come to believe in something. Doesn't ask you to ever return to any old sick feeling. You got to come to believe in something. You got to be willing to try it out. Can't you believe in God? I said, not in the way you want me to, Bob. He said, can't you believe in AA? I said, well, I like it better than I used to, but not much. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, of course you are, Bob. He said, congratulations, I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that, because he could not send me to hell. He tried and couldn't. But I came to believe in my sponsor. And over a period of time, as a result of taking action, I came to believe in AA. And I came to eventually believe in God when someone was kind enough to point out to me after some time that you're not important enough for God to hate. Why just fit in? Much to my surprise. I remember saying my first prayer in my little one-room apartment in Hollywood I had at that time. I just forgave me sober. I was just waiting for a lightning bolt to say, oh, there he is now. Whap! You know. But it, over a period of time, I really had some help. My sponsor died, and I was doing very well. I just got a job in Hollywood, television, radio and television. Another guy and I had just created the number one hard rock station in the world, number one in the country, called Boss Radio. KSJ just was so hot, slick. And I just was doing fine. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my pocket and rushed to California to be at my side to get in on the free dough. And I was doing swell. And I spoke on my 7th birthday at the Southern California Convention. And it's Bakersfield. And it was on my birthday, oddly enough. There was a Sunday afternoon speaker there. They don't have that anymore. It was and I spoke on Sunday afternoon. And I was doing so well. The leader of the meeting was someone I sponsored. The first speaker was someone I sponsored. The person who read chapter 5 was someone I sponsored. And then I came. Old woman named Polly Hall interrupted my talk. Brought down a cake and I blew it out in the middle of my talk for 7 years. And oh, God, how slick. And on the way home, I was driving home. I had a guy with me named Tommy O'Mara and my wife. And I was coming across something called the Grapevine, a long, winding thing on the way back to Los Angeles. And suddenly, I was thinking to myself, geez, can you imagine that 7 years ago on Skid Row, that's your teeth. And now you're just as hot as a pistol, just wonderful. If anything bad happened to you, who could you possibly call? And I couldn't think of anybody. Because I knew something bad about everybody. Bill Wilson by this time was taking niacin. Doesn't make you goofy, but you shouldn't be taking anything. And I went through a list of names. Chuck Chamberlain, nice man, but a little smarmy. Love. We talk about love a lot. Jesus. And a whole bunch of names. And it suddenly struck me. I may be closer to getting drunk at this moment than I have been since the day I got sober. I'm about to go out the top of AA, and I'd seen people do that. They and God walk together away. And one day God gives them a beer, and they come back. So I got home. Who could I possibly have to be my sponsor? I believe strongly in sponsors. I didn't have a sponsor for 2 years. Didn't need it. I didn't think. And I'm very active. That's just what I do. I've been active since the day I got sober, since I got discovered I should be. And I've been active, always involved, doing a lot of things. And I have to get somebody ahead of me who's more active than I am, who's doing something, who's showing me, not telling me, but showing me. And All I could think of was that dumb old Chuck Chamberlain. I thought, God, he'll make me become some kind of a religious freak. But I called up at his home in Laguna Beach. Incidentally, his phone number is in the book, like mine is. I've always been fascinated by AA members who take out their phone number. And I called him. I said, Chuck, this is Clancy Emerson. Could I come down and see you at your office? Well, I didn't know him very well. He said, yes, you can come down. He gave me the address. I went down in the morning. By this time, I wasn't quite so avid to get a sponsor. But I thought, what the hell? I sat down. He said, yes, Clancy, what can I do for you? He's a very nice man. I said, Chuck, probably surprise you, but I've come down to ask you to be my sponsor. He said, oh, really? What a surprise, Clancy. I was at where you spoke yesterday afternoon, and I thought you'd come down to offer to be mine. You know something that made me really think he's going to be all right? He's not as good as I was afraid he was. And he became my sponsor. And I called him regularly. And he never told me one thing to do in the next 20 years. I called him a lot. You never? One thing he asked of me ever. In 1966, I guess, the Dodgers were playing in the World Series. He called me. He says, Clancy, I really want to go to the World Series, but they're sold out. Is there any way you can give me a couple tickets? Sure, Chuck. And I tried all my sources. There wasn't a ticket available anywhere. I remember I had a new guy I was working with named Byron Waldine. You remember Byron? He had told me that somehow he had gotten two tickets. And I called him up. I said, Byron, this is your sponsor. Sometimes we're called upon to make sacrifices here. And I could hear him cry over the phone, but he brought me the two tickets. And I took him down to Laguna Beach to my sponsor. I said, here's a couple tickets, Chuck. Let me know if you need anything else. That's the only thing he ever asked me in all those years. But he showed me with his actions on a continuing basis what a good member is like. And in order to win his approval, he didn't approve of me at all because I was all active and mouthy and dynamic. In fact, he came up to speak at my birthday at my first year after I was his sponsor. I mean, he was my sponsor. And we had a very active group. It was active then, but nowhere near as big as it is now, but it was active. And a lot of people there for my birthday. And, oh, Clancy, happy birthday. And we're all going up to my house for a coffee afterwards. And he got up and said, I really feel kind of humble being asked to fill in between chapter 5 and the coronation. And after, when I got up to take my birthday cake, I said, Chuck, I want you to know, this is nothing unusual. We do this for everybody's birthday. We all go over to my house afterwards and have a birthday party. It's always the same. I'm just another AA in this group. Really? Okay. Now I want you to come over. Okay. So after the meeting, I helped clean up. I went back to my house. People were already over there. And neighbors were out looking. And I looked around the corner. And I parked my car. And I came around the corner. And some guys, Byron Waldine among others, Clint Hodges, a bunch of new little snots from the class of 66, had rented a big Hollywood Klieg light and put it in my driveway. And I walked by and there was Mr. Chamberlain standing there. Just another birthday, hey, kid? What a little thing is that? But he got me to take actions that nobody else would ever get me to take. I've often thought about that. If Chuck Chamberlain were my sponsor when I was new, I'd have been dead. Yeah. If Bob was my sponsor when I was 10 years sober, I'd have told him to go screw himself. But just, if you can find the... To me, sponsorship is so vital. I told you a long story about my sponsorship. There's sponsors. There's all kinds of sponsors. There's sponsors who sponsor with warmth and softness and love. And you say, well, that can't possibly work, except they got a bunch of people staying sober based on warmth and love and kindness. other people get raised, help people raise hell. You say, I wouldn't want to take that, but it saves their life. It's an interesting thing. All over the world, there are things called pockets of enthusiasm. A place where the people are involved in AA and going to meetings and going to conferences. And then you go for 100 miles of dreary, dreary meeting. Well, my counselor said I had to go to a meeting this month, and I'm not sure there's a... Then there's another pocket of... And Dick has a great pocket of enthusiasm. A little town called Bellevue, Nebraska, a suburb of Omaha, if you can imagine that. And he gets 400 or 500 people in his meeting, and everywhere you go, there's people in that damn group involved in doing things. All over the country, there are little pockets like that. I like to think we have one in my home group. Johnny Harris has one. Now, what do these pockets of enthusiasm all have in common? They all are based on a strong sponsorship ethic. Every one of them has a strong sponsorship ethic. Now, why would that have anything to do with anything? Because where there's a strong sponsorship ethic, people are being goaded, coaxed, and driven into taking actions they would not otherwise take. And they get involved in the program. As they get involved in the program, it begins to flower within them. And they do better, and they get interested. It isn't just some dreary thing you have to do once a week. It's something you can't wait to do until tomorrow night. And again, the sponsor. I know of no single thing that is healthier than sponsorship. Now, sometimes there are not enough people to sponsor. I mean, I know that. Smaller groups, there's people want to be a sponsor, and there's nobody to sponsor. But in these cases, you could help people. You could be of kindness to people. I tell people, find someone who's new and give them a ride. Do something. Go out of your way. Get out of self. It's not surprising in the book they talk about when all else fails, you work with another alcoholic. Why is that? Because you're good? No, just the opposite. For the same reason that psychiatry doesn't work very well with people like us. Psychiatry has never had much of a track record with alcoholics because they want to get inside of us and make us see ourselves. And we've been there all along. Don't tell me. I know that shit, doctor. AA forces us out. Forces us to open our armor a little bit, to do something, to get involved, to be focused on others. When I'm thinking about that sick puke, I'm not thinking about this sick puke. That's the name of the game in sponsorship. It is important, I think, to have a sponsor. For people like me, who immersed in self and smug, I needed someone who would make me do things and take action and make me do them. Some people, they revolt at that. It doesn't make a difference. But you have to have someone there. And if you're very fortunate, you will find someone, whatever who he is or she is, that you will believe knows how you feel. That is such a great, great breakthrough. I think when I started to believe that is when my sobriety began to bear fruit. And little by little, to avoid the curse of withdrawing into my loneliness. I'll tell you a funny thing. Bob was a great teacher to me. He knew more about AA practically than almost anybody I ever knew. When I was about 4 years sober, 4.5 years sober, he and his wife had a Mongolian idiot child that they spent a lot of time with. The Mongolian idiot child died. And he and his wife got fighting. And he, little by little, wasn't active in AA anymore. Pacific Palisades group he founded, he got mad at them because they changed the format when he was gone once and never went to there again. Then stopped going to meetings. Went down to the beach to this new thing called Synanon, which was just for drug addicts. And I saw him. I said, Bob, Jesus, you're not going to any meetings. You told me you have to go to meetings. He says, can I talk to you about God? Don't tell me what to do about AA. For Christ's sake, get away from me. And after a while, he got terribly depressed, and he realized his case was different again. And he went to a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist put him on strong medications, and the medications eventually got him to, as they many times do for people like us, they push the forget I'm an alcoholic button. and he had some drinks, and he died drunk, face down drunk, on his own vomit. And I looked at him, and people said, you know, Clancy, I hope this is going to make you drunk. You know, you're not doing all that well, and Jesus, your sponsor's drunk. I said, no. He put an exclamation point on what he told me. He always said to me, if you don't do these things, you'll get drunk. And he stopped doing these things, and he got drunk. And I visit his grave every year, and I tell him what's going on, but I'm not at all threatened by what he did. I'm reassured by what he did, although I hate to say it. Because if you're new, I hope that you'll always remember that sponsorship leads people like us. If we knew, I can't imagine telling alcoholics, well, you do what you think is right. That's what's got you here, for Christ's sake. You have to find someone to superimpose different perceptions, sober perceptions. Because as we often say, this is a disease of perception. And what changes here as I stay today, my perceptions gradually change. Because in sponsorship and getting a sponsor, although we don't remember this, it's the most important single gift there is in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new, you probably don't know you got it yet, but you have it. And if you can be here for a while, you may not know you have it either, but you got it. The one thing that sets this aside from all of the therapies, all other efforts to get people sober, all of our efforts to straighten out alcoholics, we have it here. It boils down in the last analysis to this. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe. And when that moment comes, the miracle of AA begins. Thank you.